You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Good afternoon and welcome to The Wire for Thursday the 18th of April. Ko Olivia Holdsworth toko ingoa. I'll be your host today, filling in for Stuart. Joining me in studio today is Laura and Ben. How are you guys?
Kia ora.
Doing alright.
Got any plans for Easter?
No, I don't celebrate things. I'm just happy to have a day off.
That's good. And yourself, Ben?
I was probably going to be working.
Okay.
Then I'll probably go to the supermarket and buy all the cheap eggs after.
Oh, sounds uncomfortable, actually.
How?
Just eggs in general. Eggs are gross.
If I can, coming up on the show today, Labour's Andrew Little is here for his weekly chat. Lillian Hanley speaks with him about the capital gains tax, hate speech and more. After that, Laura gives us the report on the capital gains tax. Next, I talk to lawyer Stephen Moore about the legal framework surrounding social enterprises in New Zealand. Laura then speaks with Green MP Gauris Garaman about identity politics. And finally, we hear from Ben with This Day in History, going back to 1949 for the creation of the Republic of Ireland. Remember, you can catch all of these stories and more by podcasts on the 95BFM website. And if you want to share your thoughts with us, tuku patoe mai, you can text us on 5395 YMI, give us a call in studio on 309 3879, or tweet us at 95BFM News. Also on our Twitter account today, our weekly poll. Today's question is, do you think the Prime Minister is right to rule out any possibility of a capital gains tax in the future?
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Andrew Little has been in Washington, D.C. for a meeting with the Financial Action Task Force, talking about money laundering and financial terrorism. But we catch up with him this morning after Labour's major announcement yesterday.
Now, I do have to mention the capital gains tax announcement. The Prime Minister announced there was no mandate from the New Zealand public to go ahead with it. What does this actually mean?
Well, if you have a look at the government is made up of three parties, and in order to get votes and pass laws, we have to have all three parties who are signed up to government on board. That government, because it has the majority of numbers of in Parliament, can be loosely described as carrying the mandate for the majority from the majority of New Zealanders. But the reality is, when the three parties between us, if we can't agree on specific things, then we don't have the numbers to pass laws in Parliament, so we don't do that. The issue about capital gains tax has been brewing for some months now. We had the Independent Tax Working Group report. We've been working through the recommendations in that report, including about capital gains tax, and in the end we couldn't reach agreement between the three parties about what would be a workable approach on capital gains tax, so we will not be having a capital gains tax, at least in the form that was recommended, which was on investment properties and other investments.
Right, because there are a number of other recommendations that will be taken up, obviously. Would you explain some of those things that would be positive for us, particularly Labour supporters?
There's a fair amount of work going on to make sure that multinationals are paying their fair share of tax. There's international work going on around that, but we are doing our part, and we've yet to come up with new tax laws to make sure that is happening. The other area is making sure that property speculators are being complying with the current laws that we've got and are properly paying their fair share of tax. The previous government introduced a thing they call the bright line test, which is actually capital gains tax. And that is, the rule is there, if you buy an investment property and then sell it within now 5 years, then you're liable to pay tax on the capital gain on that sort of property. We want to make sure that that law is being properly enforced, and so we will continue down that path and make adjustments as we can.
Could I just also mention, because the Prime Minister emphasised that there would be a focus on land banking, is that true?
Yeah, and so we're looking at, there's further work going to look at those people who buy land that ought to be developed, particularly in urban areas and within urban boundaries, but sit on it knowing that other developments going on around it will increase that value, and they sit on it doing nothing. And it's long been talked about, should you do something to require them with a through your local council you pay a premium rate for undeveloped land or something like that. We wanted to work with the local government on that. It's not just a central government issue. And look, that may well be fertile ground to do something more. So look, there's a program of work that will continue to come out of the independent tax working group, but it won't be the big ticket items like capital gains tax won't be part of it.
There have been other things, though, that the coalition government haven't been able to agree on, or that you've heard publicly, you know, people being disappointed about decisions. I mean, the oil and gas exploration ban, that decision was largely, you know, not very popular with people in those industries. Where is it that Labor feels that they can draw a line in the sand on this?
The issue with capital gains tax, it requires law change. Legislation has to go through Parliament. We need to have the numbers in Parliament. We know that the opposition isn't going to support it, and if one or either of the other parties that make up the government, either New Zealand First or the Greens, won't support legislation, then on the government side we don't have the numbers. So in order to bring in a capital gains tax, we would need to have changed our income tax legislation to allow that to happen. We didn't have the numbers to do it. On the oil and gas issue, we haven't had to change a law to do that. That was just a minister exercising her powers under the current legislation about letting permits for exploration or production. So the cabinet certainly had a good discussion about it, but it didn't require a law change for that policy to take effect.
Mm. If it is a coalition issue, why is it that the Prime Minister has said that there will not be a capital gains tax when she's leader, basically?
I think she's just reflecting the experience that the Labor Party has had, having campaigned on it in 2011, 2014 and 2017. And we still don't have, and you know, under coalition government, with the majority of votes of Parliament, we still don't have enough support to enact the law that would allow a capital gains tax to come in. And at some point, I think it is, you've got to make a judgment. Do you keep campaigning on this? Or do you just say, you know what, for the sake of certainty and long-term certainty, we're just saying we're not going to be raising this as part of our manifesto in the near future?
I do want to spend a bit more time talking about the hate speech law discussion that's kind of been happening. But firstly, could you explain, the terror threat has been lowered, right, from a high threat to a medium threat. What does that mean and how does that work?
There's a group called the Combined Threat Assessment Group. So it has people from police, from the spy agencies, from the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, and one or two others. So they periodically are assessing what the risks or the security risks and threats are to New Zealand. And obviously after the 15th of March, there was a heightened level of threat. And it was largely because of the risk of either copycat crime, so other right-wing extremists think they have the opportunity to do the same thing, or retaliatory action, so other extremists and other causes deciding that they would take some sort of vengeful action. And we know from overseas experience that it's a pretty orthodox approach, that for 4 to 6 weeks after an event like the 15th of March, there is a heightened risk. That Combined Threat Assessment Group had assessed that there was an ongoing heightened risk, which is why they left having put the threat level at high, they kind of left it there for a few weeks. Now their assessment is that the risk of copycat or retaliatory action is declining, therefore they can ease off the threat level. And what the threat level means is just you have a different... So we had, while the threat level was high, you had armed police stationed at various places or at various events, that all now starts peeling off,
right,
and go back to a lower threat level. So it's the precautions that are taken, certainly by government agencies, amongst others, that is reflective of the threat level of the time.
So, yes, moving into hate speech, and I know you have covered this a bit with Stuart, but there has been discussion continuing as you do fast-track the review. I guess, firstly, how is that going for you?
Well, it's with the Ministry of Justice, and they'll be talking to other agencies. I mean, I'm not expecting anything for 2 or 3 months. I know people use the language of fast-track, and there's been a sort of, certainly from some commentators on the right, this thing about, oh, it's all being done in haste. This was work that was intended to be done at some point. All I did was bring it forward, but it's following the same pattern. There'll be a considered approach, consultation with the relevant groups. They'll give me some advice, and at some point there'll then be something, a proposal, if there is to be any change, to take out to the public, and it'll go through usual kind of consultation and scrutiny processes. And that's even before you put up a law change, which would go through the usual 6 to 12 month process to enact a new law. So, look, I think it's been long noted and commented on that there are gaps in the laws we have covering hate speech, and it's a question about whether, you know, we now fill those gaps. Acutely aware that freedom of speech and freedom of expression and freedom of the press are absolutely vital, and you always have to, you know, move very cautiously when you're doing anything that might look like it compromises or encroaches on those important freedoms.
There's a newsroom article that does talk about those gaps, I suppose, and I was quite interested in the way that they talked about how there are some protections for groups defined by race, and then individuals are protected from the worst excesses of freedom of speech by defamation laws. So, I mean, to what extent can somebody who is considered racist or hateful then be protected by those defamation laws?
Well, the problem with defamation is that it's extraordinarily expensive to, if somebody makes a racist remark about you as an individual, and it, you know, lowers you in the minds of right-thinking people, as the test is, then, you know, it is tens of thousands of dollars to get some sort of justice about that. But the reality is a lot of racist speech, and deeply and offensively racist speech, is not directed at individuals. It's directed at groups of people, or people who are defined by particular characteristics. So you've got the Human Rights Act provisions there, and one of the questions is, how effective are they? How accessible are those processes? And the starting point for the Human Rights Commission is not to climb into court straight away. It is to offer a more conciliatory, restorative justice type approach. So somebody has said this, it's caused grave offence. Can we bring the parties together, talk this through, and reach some sort of agreement about it? The question is whether that is effective, whether it's been used well enough, whether the mechanisms that the Human Rights Commission have got are effective for it. So those are the sorts of things that I want to make sure that are working well.
Just to finish, we're based on the University of Auckland campus, and just like you've said, that terror threat dropping down, we've had two police stationed quite near our station since the March terror attacks, and I'm guessing that with that terror threat dropping, they will probably not be here anymore. But there have been reports actually of white supremacists on campus, and an increased visibility of those students, as well as stickers and posters, and there was a chalk graffiti of one of the phrases that was written on the guns of the terrorists from the attacks in Christchurch. So how important is it that these incidents are dealt with quite seriously and efficiently, and what role does the university have in doing so?
Well, I mean, the university has a very important role. It's their premises, and they've got, you know, they claim to have codes of conduct and rules for students and staff and frankly anybody on campus. So they should be taking appropriate action. They've got to know who to take action against. But even if the university isn't going to act, I mean, these are things that the Human Rights Commission can get involved in and maybe should be involved in. There's always going to be, I mean, the sad thing is there are some people who, in their kind of warped minds, things, and after an event like the 15th of March, they'll kind of say things that they know are going to be deliberately offensive and provocative. They get some kind of jollies off it, I don't know. And then there are some who are, you know, who believe in it and are a potential risk or threat to others. And I think at this point, anybody engaging in anything that looks like it's promoting or encouraging the same sort of warped views that the person behind the 15 March mosque attacks was, actually, you know, the authorities should be taking action on that and sending a very clear message that that stuff isn't acceptable.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
All right, now it's time to take a quick break on The Wire. Next up, we'll hear Laura having a little rant on the capital gains tax. If you have any thoughts, give me a text on 5395. You're listening to BFM.
Right, job's pretty straightforward. When dinner's ready, you ring this gong.
How do I know when dinner's ready?
The gong rings.
This gong?
Yeah, when dinner's ready.
Who rings it?
You do.
But how do I know when to do it?
You do it when dinner's ready!
Listen for the Dinner Gong on 95 BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry, and you could win a workshop catered by The Cater Station, the top option for catering your crew. Winner must work within Auckland. Check out thecaterstation.co.nz.
Celebrate New Zealand Music Month at Alan Melville Centre. Every Friday in May, Alan Melville Centre are hosting a live broadcast of 95 BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. Plus, guest DJs spinning Kiwi classics and incredible free live musical performances. Featuring Skila, Chai, Being, Lucky Boy, Sir Friends, Ounce, and DJs Zach Arnold, Dubhead, Tina Turntables and Sigrid. New Zealand Music Month at Alan Melville Centre. Free live music every Friday in May, 4 to 7pm. For more info, find Alan Melville Centre on Facebook or go to 95bfm.com.
Biscuits and fresh vegetables every Tuesday from 7pm. Replayed 4am Wednesday and always online at 95bfm.com. Check it.
Thanks to the Lee Sawmill Cafe.
Now we'll be hearing from Laura, who'll talk about the capital gains tax.
Yesterday, it was announced a capital gains tax would not be adopted by government. As noted by Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, the coalition could not come to a consensus on this matter.
Today, I am announcing that the coalition government has ruled out implementing a capital gains tax. I campaigned on capital gains because I believed New Zealand's tax system could and should be fairer.
The Labour Party campaigned in the 2011, 2014 and 2017 election on a capital gains tax, while the Green Party wanted to extend the recommendations from the tax working group on a capital gains tax even further. They wanted to include the family home. New Zealand First, however, did not agree with the capital gains tax. When questioned on the decision on capital gains tax, Deputy Leader Winston Peters had this to say.
I agree with her comments, I thank her for them. In particular, her gratitude to the tax working group that had some very substantial changes that which we will work on. And on the issue of capital gains tax, we couldn't agree.
Capital gains tax has been a polarizing issue, with some taking an anti-tax stance, concerned that increasing taxation was impinging on personal freedom. Leader of the opposition, Simon Bridges, had this to say.
This was really the big economic idea that Labour had, and they haven't been able to deliver on it. And I think, you know, people will be asking questions about that.
Do you think it's because she realised it was political suicide to even suggest the idea?
Well, they've gone into a number of elections with it. I mean, I think ultimately National has had a relentless opposition to this, to the extent where people have been critical of us, but we've kept coming back to this. So it's a big win for National. It's a big win for the New Zealanders, for New Zealanders, I think, here. We've embarrassed the government into this.
Now, I want to touch on taxation as I understand it. Taxation is the price we pay for a well-functioning society. Everything from the nurse's salary, to roads, to your grandpa tagging on to the bus with his gold hop card, to research and development, to the power line you use to charge your cell phone that you're about to use to text me a message berating me. They're paid for by taxes. Do you really not want grandpa to be able to catch the bus now, Jerry? In fact, unless you've gone all hunt for the wilder people, live in the woods, unconnected to anything happening in New Zealand society, you probably used something in the last hour paid for by your taxes. A tax is neither good nor bad. It is how the taxation is spent and where it comes from. What a capital gains tax can attempt to address is inequity. A basic explanation of how the tax would work is if you make a profit on a sale of an investment property, the profit would be taxed. The CGT went as far as to be called an attack on the Kiwi way of life by Simon Bridges. Many concerns were raised from those who were current homeowners and property investors. Commentary from current owners of investment properties said by introducing a capital gains tax, it would cut into their retirement investments. The concerns about retirement are not isolated for any one generation, though. Retirement is an expensive feat and no doubt another sector of society that needs to be addressed in order to make sure older New Zealanders are being looked after. Simply put, the same patterns of investing in property can't be followed by the next generation. Many millennials don't believe they will ever own a home, which leaves concerns for what this means to the state of retirement amongst an aging population who don't expect to have any property to sell off. In recent research from the Financial Services Council, we saw that only half of millennials expected to own their own home by the time they retired, meaning that more are placing a greater emphasis on KiwiSaver. In fact, millennials are the most engaged with KiwiSaver, more than any other generation. In addition, only 30% of millennials expect to have New Zealand superannuation by the time they retire. A report from the University of Otago states that we're staring down the barrel of a future generation of non-home owners, being less able to achieve acceptable standards of living when they retire because of the critical factor of home ownership. New Zealand superannuation is based on the assumption that recipients are homeowners. It's clear through statistics and current attention on housing affordability that this is becoming less of a reality for many New Zealanders. The longer policymakers take to address this issue, the worse it will be for many New Zealanders. While this could be seen as a good thing for those who believe personal accountability is the most important factor for economic development, the question about whether KiwiSaver will be enough to support those retiring remains to be seen. This commentary we've seen over the last decade, work harder, eat less avocado toast, and take personal responsibility for yourself, could easily be seen as bad economics. Asking people not to engage with local businesses to buy that avocado toast isn't necessarily something to encourage because it means local businesses aren't being supported. In fact, one of the most important things we can do to build an economy is to have people who are of a lower socioeconomic background be supported. Why? Well, because when they can buy more, that stimulates the economy. If the majority of income goes into housing and the basic needs of the individual, then they cannot do something like buy a coffee from a local coffee shop. The business then can't employ an extra staff member for the busy period because, well, there is no busy period. The personal isn't so personal when it has a flow-on effect. In 2017, Statistics New Zealand reported nearly a third of all investment by Kiwis went into houses. This was the highest it had ever been since records began being kept 45 years ago. To contrast, in the same 2017 report, since 2010, business investment, which excluded residential buildings, hadn't moved. It was stationary at around 15%. While this is correlation rather than causation, it indicates where New Zealanders believe they should be investing. When we look at housing as an investment rather than homes, it takes the humanity out of the conversation. No doubt you caught on to the concerns about spikes in the rental market due to taxation. This appeared rather as a way to end the conversation. This could have been an opportunity to ask, how do we make sure rental properties are operating in a way that is ethical and doesn't promote poverty? Instead, it became a way to disparage the tax altogether. Auckland Council released the report, Exploitative Landlord-Tenant Relationships in Auckland, back in 2017. They reported, as the gap between incomes and the cost of housing continues to rise, concerns are emerging at exploitative practices of landlords, impacting in particular on vulnerable tenants. This is visible in substandard accommodation, unhealthy, overcrowded, derelict, and dirty homes, illegal practices, unconsented conversions and sewerage systems, and informal arrangements such as sex in exchange for rent. By not regulating the market in a way that provides people with affordable choices, we leave the power in the landlord's hands. I myself have personally had to consider living in my car, had to pay $450 in rent by myself as a student, know of more than four people at BFM who live in rat-infested homes and have friends who have been homeless. Each week I speak with the National Party, and a capital gains tax is something I've spoken about on more than one occasion. I had a conversation with Chris Bishop from the National Party earlier this year, and he explained that a rental property is already taxed once, so to tax it twice would be unfair to the landlords. I pointed this out as a flawed economic viewpoint, as the income from the rental is a business income, while the appreciation of value on the property is a separate income entirely. While I don't pretend that the capital gains tax would have been a cure-all for the housing crisis, by not introducing it, we are continuing to make investment out of housing, something the United Nations Human Rights Declaration says is a basic human right. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said that there appeared to be no consolidated support amongst the public of New Zealand. But I guess my question is, how often has 100% of the New Zealand public agreed on something? Do we always have to agree in order to look after people who are vulnerable? For now, though, it's safe to say New Zealand will continue to be one of three countries in the OECD without a capital gains tax for as long as Jacinda Ardern is in leadership.
All right, now it is time.
Freedom of speech, it means you have to listen to me.
It's time to have your say. Poll position on The Wire.
So our question today was, do you think the Prime Minister is right to rule out any possibility of a capital gains tax? And from our Twitter poll, 100% of the voters have said no. What do you guys think?
I agree.
Yeah. Are you surprised it's 100%?
I'm not, just because of BFM's listenership.
Yeah.
we tend to lean a little left. But I think overall, not introducing a capital gains tax was just poor economic viewpoint.
Mm. And furthermore, that it's completely ruled out in the future at all. That's the surprising part.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that while we did get a call just before, someone saying that this kind of secures Labour's political standing, I think for a lot of people, myself included, voting for Labour is something that I would be a little bit more tentative about, seeing that they're not willing to kind of stand on principle.
But exactly. It's also like, who else are you going to vote for? The Greens.
Yeah. I don't know. It does kind of make you think, oh, so...
maybe National.
Oh, yeah. Who knows? Yeah. Any...
I mean, do you want me to just disagree for the sake of it, so we're not just all...
Do you disagree?
Not really. I mean, I do wonder if we're all assuming Jacinda is going to stay in for three terms. Because I think she's hinted that she might just stay in for one term, and everyone's like, oh, she's obviously lying. But I think she's said a lot about how she has anxiety, and now she's got the kid that she probably wants to spend some time with. And it was only in her government. Mm. So you could say it's leaving it open. Plus, you know, politicians go back on stuff all the time, so... I'm still fairly optimistic.
Oh, Ben. Oh,
that's nice.
Ben always tries to be the optimist. So sweet. Good.
It's called democracy, sweetie. Look it up.
That was Poll Position on The Wire.
So a new report has come out talking about how current company laws are hampering the development of New Zealand's social enterprise sector. I spoke to co-author of the report, Stephen Moe, about this legal framework, and I started by asking him to tell me a bit more about the current law affecting its growth.
Well, the current law is that there's no recognition of social enterprise as a unique way of doing business. So people are faced with a choice. Do I become a company or do I become a charity? That's sort of the legal framework in New Zealand, and people have to either choose one or the other. Whereas social enterprise is really a combination, a blending of the heart of charity and the mind of business, and saying, actually, we can do things with purpose, we can advance a social or environmental cause, and we can make money, so we're not reliant on handouts or somebody just giving donations.
What are the current actual problems with, let's say, a social enterprise registering as a company? How does that prevent them from actually carrying out their purpose?
Yeah, it's not that it prevents carrying out their purpose. It's more that it doesn't empower them to carry out their purpose. In New Zealand, under Companies Act, there's no requirement that the mission of a company be defined or be clearly set out. And so social enterprises find that a barrier when they come to explain their story, because there's nothing that written into the Constitution about what their mission or their purpose is. And so that becomes a hurdle for them when they go for funding or when they're going out to the public to explain who they are. It's a barrier to explaining their story.
Mm. Also, the report mentioned issues around difficulty accessing funding. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, the problem for a social enterprise is that often they're about more than just how many profits can be made and how many dividends can go back to shareholders. So it's a part of the explanation piece to a funder is that you will get returns, but you're also empowering impact beyond the financial benefit. So it makes it a difficult story to tell to funders about why they should invest in the company.
Is there anything going on in New Zealand which is currently empowering social enterprise, or are these legal frameworks still really behind and actually, you know, hindering their successes?
Yeah, well, the fascinating thing is that in New Zealand, we have a chance to learn from what's actually already being done around the world. So if you look at America, if you look at England, if you look at different jurisdictions, they've put in place frameworks for about 10 years ago they started. So we can actually learn what's worked, what hasn't, and adopt the best bits here in New Zealand.
Can you tell me a bit about the frameworks you think would be useful and applicable in New Zealand to help empower these enterprises?
Yeah, for us, it comes back to making sure that the mission of the company is clearly enshrined and that everybody understands that this is a different breed of company. It's something that we call in the report an impact company. So it's actually recognizing a different status for this type of company. And then it's requiring that there be clear reporting on the impact so that people can have trust and confidence that the company is actually doing what they say they'll do.
What kind of steps do you think need to be taken going forward, let's say within the next year or so?
Well, what we'd love to do is for people to read the report, see what we had to say. We don't provide a full answer. We just give some suggestions of how we think things could be improved. This is really a journey that we need to go on with all people, including government departments, to work out what's going to work for New Zealand. Mm. But the chance is to create something that's bespoke and unique here in Aotearoa that actually reflects our culture, our values, and then can integrate some of Te Ao Māori, which, of course, for a very long time, forever, has had more in mind than just the financial returns of what a company can give. And that's really the opportunity that we're presented here. How can we create something that's unique, world-leading, but relevant for New Zealand?
Mm. Do you have any last comments you'd like to make just regarding what you want to do going forward or how this report can actually assist in creating legislation to empower social enterprises?
Yeah, the latest statistics that we've got is that there's more than 3,700 social enterprises in New Zealand and contributing about $1 billion to the economy. So we're not just talking about some startups or something like that. There's actually established organizations which have been operating for decades that are working in this space. They may not have known that they were social enterprises, but what we're hoping is that people can read this report, be challenged by some of these ideas that actually business can be a force for good. And then if we can come together and have discussions, work out, is there a legal framework which might actually empower the future generations to look at business as a way to not only make money, but also contribute back to our society and help this become an even better place to live.
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
For Wire Worry Week this week, we've been discussing optic politics and the media. What this means is the various viewpoints that get represented in our political systems and the media. When Green MP and spokesperson for human rights Gulruz Gutterman became a candidate in politics, it was noted she would be the first refugee New Zealand MP. I wanted to hear what she had to say about the place of identities in politics, so I asked her how she sees identities being political.
To me, politics and identity are inseparable because, of course, you know, we all bring what we've lived as our experiences to our politics, whether that's as parents or as members of a particular ethnic group, whether it's as tangata whenua, students, young people, it's politics, because politics is all about representation, democracy is all about representation, and that should be something that's celebrated. But of course, now we see this kind of weaponization of the term identity politics, and it seems to only be weaponized against members of a minority group speaking to the interests of that minority group.
And I guess along that similar vein of thinking, do you think that New Zealand potentially has a problem in its political system with excluding people who are marginalized?
Yeah, I think that's actually really apparent, because when I first ran as a candidate and someone figured out that I'd be the first ever refugee MP, that kind of came to the forefront for me inadvertently. But then as you start to look at it more and more closely, and you look at the age range of Parliament, you look at the gender representation, you look at ethnic representation, and when you think about, for example, Pacific people's representation in our politics, and we are a Pacific capital, and we've only got a very small handful of people in those leadership roles, and then you kind of come down into the local government, and that stuff just falls away. So you do, have to ask, is it enough for us to be given one vote per person as minorities, or is that just kind of this majority rule politics that will never, ever serve our interests? And when you think about things like the rights of disabled persons or the rainbow community, it gets more and more dire. So, yeah, we do need to have minorities at the decision-making table, because how else are our issues even going to come to the fore, and are we actually being ghettoized as sort of these interest, little small interest groups, rather than being part of the mainstream when someone considers something like housing, because that's not a minority issue, but minorities are experiencing it in different ways. The disabled community is going to experience housing in a different way, and how is someone who doesn't know that lived experience going to identify their issues in housing, for example?
And I suppose whenever identity politics, as you brought up, it's something that's been weaponized, but it also comes in parallel with this commentary about free speech and people being able to say whatever they want about other groups of people. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I find it interesting that, when you talk about identity politics, it almost always means minority identities, because nobody sort of says, well, actually, the needs and interests of able-bodied persons have been prioritized in city planning, or the needs and interests of straight people are. That actually is an identity point, prioritizing, a world where that is the identity that's being well served, is itself identity politics. And then when you look at something like free speech, and people talk about free speech, they're never talking about taking away the very valid, very long-standing limitations on free speech that protect individuals and can be enforced by individuals, against people that have hurt them through speech. So something like defamation, where you can't harm a person's reputation by lying about them, is illegal, and no one's ever fighting to sort of legalize that. But why is it that I can't say that a particular person is, for example, a terrible criminal or a pedophile even? Well, because that would harm their chances of getting a job or walking down the street safely. But I can say that and make up fake articles, share them, make up Facebook groups, share that kind of false information that really hurts, for example, gay men or Muslims. I can do it when it's about a group of people. Or harassment. You can't do that if it's aimed at an individual, but then you can do it when it's an entire group, where it's a minority religious group. You can actually rile up that hate, for example, where it can result in real violence or against women. So you kind of go, well, powerful identities get protection. Individuals get protection. You can go to court. But you can't if you're a minority that's already suffering different points of oppression. And are you really fighting for free speech there? Or are you fighting for the right to harm minorities through speech?
Something you also have mentioned previously in one of your speeches was that you feel journalism has been killed off. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, you know, we've got a situation, and I think future generations are going to look back on this and kind of find it astounding that we don't really regulate online spaces, because we can all kind of go online and live our lives online. Our real lives are lived online. You know, it's not something that you can really shut off anymore. People have to work online and connect online, you know, run businesses online, go to sort of be educated online. And information channels are all there, but pretty much unregulated. So you can kind of, you can choose what information you consume, you can become radicalized, you can start entire movements online, and we don't regulate them. Whereas something like journalism is regulated, because we do kind of recognize that it's not in the interest of the public to have people be able to publish hateful things, to rile hostility against members of the community, to lie, for example. You know, we have broadcasting standards. But actually, because these online platforms are now far more powerful, we need to think really hard about what that means for journalism, for that kind of ethics-based information sharing mechanism that is public broadcasting and public interest journalism. So we've killed that off because we don't pay for it anymore. We're not willing to pay for it. We get all this other information for free. But it's also harmful to us and to sort of the health of our society.
Worry Week on The Wire.
It's time for a quick break on The Wire. Next up, we'll hear Ben with This Day in History, going back to 1949 for the creation of the Republic of Ireland. If you have any thoughts, give me a text on 5395. You're listening to BFM.
There's a lot inside a 95BFM B-card. Check out these sweet B-card discounts from our mates, including
Arcade,
Fume,
Lord of the Fries,
Mezzo Bar,
Mister's Cafe,
Nice Touch Massage,
Pat Menzies Shoes,
Red Bar,
and loads more.
Support independent media from as little as $4.20 a month with a B-card. For full discount information, go to 95bfm.com/B-card benefits.
This week at the Hollywood Avondale.
It's school holidays, so the week starts with kid-friendly classics on 35mm daily at 2pm. Milo and Otis on Monday, the 1940 original Pinocchio on Tuesday, and Once Upon a Forest on Wednesday. Then on Thursday, it's the original teen vampire movie, The Lost Boys, at 7:30pm.
The Hollywood Avondale, your local independent church of cinema. Tickets and details at hollywoodavondale.nz or our Facebook page.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words, because he waka eke noa.
Ho ake tātou.
Today, our bonds are forged in blood and iron. Today, we take Great Grithel the dragon. Ho ake tātou, to our destiny.
Not you though, Brian. Pay your membership, Brian. Terrible. Get it together.
Ho ake tātou. Māori words, karawhiua. Give it a go.
Citizens, to This Day in History with Benjamin J. Goldson.
Yes, This Day in History, going back to 1949 for the creation of the Republic of Ireland. And now it's a bit confusing here, as it always is with history, because this is the official creation of the Republic of Ireland out of the Irish Free State, which had been established in 1921 by the Anglo-Irish Treaty, which is Ireland as we know it today. But it wasn't called the Republic, because it was all this because it was technically a dominion like New Zealand is. And there was a lot of controversy about that in the Irish sort of nationalist republican movement over the people who said, well, just... Because all it really meant is that they had to swear loyalty to the king. And a lot of them said, oh, we're not going to do that. Some of them said, oh, we might as well. So you had a sort of mini civil war about that. But generally, the army did side with the pro-treaty forces.
Some 25,000 troops and civil defence workers parade at the General Post Office in Dublin for inspection by Mr. De Valera, who is accompanied by Major General McKenna on the left and Major General McNeil. Colour party and escort precede the march past, with the President taking the salute on the stand. The fine bearing of the men makes the procession one of the most impressive ever held in the capital. Planes sweep across a clear sky as mechanized troops move forward below. Light Bryn carriers lead the way. Armored cars roll leisurely along as if proud to show off their strength. But it's the steady swing of the long line of marchers that makes the picture, the moving cavalcade of ERA's own sons in the cause of defense. And still they come, engineers, signals, supply, transport, ACAC, and so on, all helping to make a grand spectacle for the dense crowds.
So yes, after this sort of minor civil war in the early 20s, the anti-treaty forces grouped together into the, and I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation here, the Fianna Fáil, which was the sort of more hardline Republican nationalist faction that really gained power in the sort of mid to late 30s and would pursue an official policy of neutrality in World War II.
Some of the military reasons which brought about the joint Anglo-American action to seal Northern Ireland from Axis spies in ERA. Mr. de Valera's neutrality permits German agents to establish themselves in an easy position for the collecting of vital information. Travel facilities between Great Britain and ERA and Northern Ireland were swiftly dealt with. The Dublin-Belfast train is pulled up for close inspection by military police and constabulary. Germany and Japan are no respecters of neutrality. Slipping their spies over the border was far too easy. The Allies are much too close to big moves to permit ERA to jeopardize the success of our operations. The North-South border is sealed. Credentials have to be right. Britain and America take this step to safeguard the lives of their forces. It puts an end to the situation where we work while others peep.
And now, then, after World War II, sort of Irish Republican forces would finally emerge very strongly and finally make the country a republic on this day in history, 1949.
408 years after Henry VIII was crowned King of Ireland, ERA cuts its last link with Britain. President Seán Kelly, the new state's first leader, joins a dense crowd in Dublin's O'Connell Street as the flag of ERA is hoisted on the GPO building. Here, as the veterans of the 1916 rebellion still recall, was the headquarters of the Sinn Féin Rising. And here, 33 years later to the day, the new ERA officially becomes an independent republic. There follows the biggest military review Dublin has seen for years. Units of the Republican Army parade past President O'Kelly. So comes into being the world's youngest republic. Although out of the Commonwealth, ERA's many common interests with Britain will still keep the two nations close partners in the years to come.
And the Irish Republic would continue to sort of pursue a quite sort of strong nationalist line, and then you later had the conflict with Northern Ireland, or sort of in Northern Ireland rather, which it's always disputed, you know, to what degree was the Republic of Ireland involved with sort of supporting the IRA in North Ireland, and that's of course very controversial, so I'm not going to get into that. So I'll probably just play this clip here to play us out.
President Seán O'Kelly and his lady lead Ireland in a celebration of the Feast of St. Patrick. Highlight of the day in Dublin is the solemn High Mass at the Pro Cathedral. After the Mass, the celebrant of which was the Reverend Dr. McNevin, large crowds greet the Archbishop of Dublin and Primate of all Ireland as he leaves the cathedral, having presided over the service. Following his grace to the presbytery come the President and Mrs. O'Kelly. Rarely has the Day of Ireland's patron saint been so keenly observed. As Mr. O'Kelly and his wife leave the presbytery, the crowds who line the narrow street throng around the presidential car to wish the head of state well. O'Connell Street is a centre of attraction in the afternoon when crowds in holiday mood turn out for a special St. Patrick's Day parade. Headed by girl pipers is a procession of floats displaying Irish produce. Dublin streets are turned into an open industrial fair as with impressive pageantry, Irish industry shows its march of progress. It's a procession the like of which the capital has not seen for many a year. All the way to Parnell Square, the pageant is cheered by tens of thousands as Dublin and Ireland celebrate a great day in its history.
Now we've had a text sort of picking me up on my pronunciation, saying it's actually Fianna Fáil.
Fianna Fáil.
Which, I mean, all I did was watch a YouTube video of an Irish person saying this is how to pronounce it, so...
Blame it on YouTube.
Yeah, I can't remember their name, but take it up with them.
There we go.
That was The Wire.
And that was The Wire for Thursday, the 18th of April. Thank you all for tuning in and sending in your feedback. We all really appreciate it. A big thank you to all of those who joined us in the show today. Andrew Little, Stephen Moe and Golis Garaman. Thank you, of course, to Laura and Ben for producing today. Whoa. And our news director, Lillian Hanley. If you've joined us halfway through, you can catch the whole show or individual segments on 95BFM's website in the BCast section. That's it from us. We won't be here next week because it's Anzac Day, but we'll be back with you the following week. The 1-4 with Sigrid is up now. Thank you, and bye.
Happy Easter.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/BCasts.